The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaetis, Judge Werke, Judge Johnson, the Honorable Theodora K. Gaetis presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is June 9th, 2021, and this morning we have four cases on our calendar, two cases scheduled for oral argument and two cases considered for non-oral consideration. I would like to welcome our attorneys in the first case. The first case that we'll be hearing is Peter Stelland et al. Versus City of Scandia, case number A20-1557. And just a few remarks for our attorneys here before we get started with your oral argument. I would ask you to please introduce yourself and identify the party you're representing before you begin the argument. Please also be mindful of our time limitations on arguments. The appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant can have 15 minutes for rebuttal if the attorney so chooses. We do have a camera appearing on our Zoom screen this morning that is keeping track of your time. Just make sure that you're attentive to the time. Now, we are having the argument this morning via the Zoom platform. The argument is being recorded and will be available to the public on our website shortly. And that ends my comments this morning. I will turn things over to the attorneys now. We'll begin with counsel for the appellant. You may begin.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Matt Anderson, and I represent all the joint appellants. The joint appellants want to dock 10 more boats on their 4,000 feet of shoreline. The city denied that request, relying on a misinterpretation of its ordinance and citing to a record that was created through ex parte communications and opposition mobilized by a council member. The joint appellants challenged in district court, and after cross motions for summary judgment, the district court issued an order dismissing their claims. There are three legal errors in that order on appeal today. First, the district court failed to weigh an ambiguous ordinance in the applicant's favor. Second, it incorrectly used a bad faith standard for the unfair process claims. And finally, it improperly resolved fact disputes against the appellants. My intent is to spend most time on issues number one and two. All three of these issues are subject to de novo review, and all of these issues are under the umbrella of an unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious decision from the city on a conditional use permit application. And this court does not need to defer to the decision-making of the local government in these cases.
Anderson, the matters come before the court, as you said, on joint motions for summary judgment. I understand what you're arguing in terms of the relief fashioned by the district court. Are you also alleging that facts preclude summary judgment? Are you asking us to send it back for any reason? And if so, can you articulate what it is that that the specific claims that you allege are in dispute?
So there's the only thing on dispute right now is the unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious claims. And there's two big claims we made under that.
But the facts in dispute that underlie that? Or are you saying the facts are before us and we, of course, can make our de novo review?
Your Honor, it's both. Under an unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious decision, facts outside of the record can be decided upon, can be included in the record for the district court review when procedural fairness is argued. We argued procedural unfairness on two different levels, but we also argued in our motion for summary judgment that on the record, the district court could grant our relief because there's an ambiguous ordinance that should have been resolved in favor of the applicants. And so on the motion that was made by the city, our argument was there were fact disputes and that could have proceeded to a district court trial of some sort. And the district court had ordered in discovery motions that it had authority to hold the trial on the matter. But this court on the ambiguous ordinance can direct or can order the application granted because of the ambiguous ordinance. And as I say, the level of discretion is de novo, and you don't need to defer to the city because a landowner actually has a right to a conditional use when they meet the right criteria. And a decision is unreasonable as a matter of law when the wrong criteria is applied. Here, the argument is that the wrong criteria was applied because case law on ambiguous land use ordinances requires the court to, quote, give weight to the interpretation that, while still within the confines of the term, is least restrictive upon the rights of the property owner to use his land as he wishes. That's Frank's Nursery versus Roseville, 295 Northwest 2nd, 604. The quote from there is 608. That's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1980.
Mr. Anderson, is it clear that that case, Frank's Nursery, and that concept applies in this context where we're not looking directly at an ordinance, we're looking at a pre-existing conditional use permit and then an application to modify it or amend it, right?
This case absolutely applies because what we are looking at is the ordinance. The way Scandia processes development agreements, specifically with a planned unit development, is it's processed as a conditional use. And an amendment is treated as its own conditional use application. And so you go back to the ordinances on what you're allowed to have. And the ordinances...
Well, wouldn't that require us to look at the specific ordinance that's provided in the PUD section of the shoreland regulations then?
Well, there's two ordinances. One of them is in the PUD section, and that's the first tier ordinance. And specifically, the first tier ordinance is the ambiguous one. But the other ordinance at play is the controlled access lot ordinance, which by its plain terms applies to all developments. The first tier ordinance is one that is specific for planned unit developments. But unlike the controlled access lot ordinance, the first tier ordinance puts a limit on spaces, not a limit on watercraft. And so the way it works is actually the first tier ordinance as it reads is the number of spaces provided for continuous beaching, mooring, or docking of watercraft must not exceed one for each allowable dwelling unit or site in the first tier. Spaces and watercraft are not defined in the ordinance. And that's sort of the heart of the ambiguity here, because spaces can be defined any which way. Respondent gave a definition of spaces as akin to a parking spot. Joint appellants had a spaces definition more along the lines of an area that's available. And so that's really the heart of it. And then watercraft can be either plural or singular. And when there's those two different terms that have multiple different meanings, it leaves the ordinance open to multiple interpretations. The one went with the city was a space is a single spot for a single watercraft. With joint appellants, it was a space is an area for multiple watercraft. The one that makes the most sense, that's the most reasonable, is the one proffered by joint appellants because, as I wrote extensive in the brief, the structure of the ordinance makes no sense if watercraft is singular. So it makes no grammatical sense to consider watercraft to be a singular.
Mr. Anderson, why?
Go ahead.
The sentence reads the number of spaces provided for .. So the use of the word number, isn't that significant in indicating that these are discrete individually identified spaces? I mean, under your interpretation, it seems like it might make more sense if the sentence just read the space provided for continuous beaching, mooring, or docking, referring to an area or something. But the use of the word number in conjunction with spaces, doesn't that cut against your argument?
It does not, Your Honor, because there's still as we said, the first tier is a limit on the number of spaces. Now, as the ordinance don't limit anyone other than developments on boat capacity. So an individual landowner can put as many boats along their property as they want to. Controlled access lot sets the number of watercraft limit, and then the space is provided. And space as a concept in other places in the ordinance is a more open definition of area. For example, open space is areas unsuitable for development. But more direct to your point is that docking isn't the only thing allowed in the first tier ordinance. Maybe it makes more sense to say one dock, one boat, but when you're talking about beaching, that has to be a wider area available for multiple boats. No beach is lined with strips of parking spaces for a boat to pull into it. The area of the beach is a spot for multiple watercraft.
Mr. Anderson, if we disagree with you on your argument that the first tier ordinance is ambiguous, and we find it to be unambiguous and applicable, do we even get to your arguments concerning the controlled access ordinance?
If it's unambiguous, then if it's unambiguous, then that means that multiple interpretations from the city along the way were by definition unreasonable. And so Neil Soltis had testified up to his deposition that the controlled access lot set the boat slip limit, not the first tier ordinance. And the city attorney at the time believed that both applied. And so in order for this court to disagree with me, it doesn't need to believe that my definition is the one that carries the day, so long as it's in a reasonable interpretation. If it's reasonable, it's the one this court has to go with. But correct, if this court believes that the first tier ordinance unambiguously applies as a boat limit, then it's the boat limit and the controlled access lot wouldn't be. But I would say a point on that is when we talk about specific versus general, that only comes into play when the ordinances are in conflict. And I don't think either side is arguing that these ordinances are in conflict. So this isn't a case where we have to talk about the planned unit development specific case, specific ordinance being the controlling ordinance. They're not in conflict. They regulate two different things. They both can work in harmony. So the district court should have went with the joint appellant's interpretation of the ordinance, which would be allow up to 134 boats based on the controlled access lot regulation and based upon their 4,000 feet of shoreline. And instead, the district court went with the city's interpretation, believing it to be the one that was most in line with the purposes behind the ordinance. The purposes, as I've said, does not come into play here at all. If it's ambiguous, need to go with the most restrictive. However, I would submit that the purpose actually favors the joint appellant's argument, because this ordinance is all based on the DNR model. And the DNR model tells cities that the controlled access lot is going to allow a lot of boats for developments. And if you don't want that, don't put the controlled access lot in your ordinance. Scandia made the legislative decision to have controlled access lots. They made the legislative decision to allow developments to have a lot of boats along the water. Keeping an eye on time, I'm going to move to issue number two, that the district court erred by applying a bad faith or improper conduct standard to the procedural unfairness claims.
Mr. Anderson, just as you move into that argument, I do have a question about it. Below, you raised a procedural due process argument and the district court ruled against you. Are you making a specific procedural due process argument on appeal? It seems to me that this is a slightly different argument that you're making. And I just want to make sure that I'm clearly understanding the contours of this argument that you're about to get into.
Correct. So under Hone versus Coon Rapids 313 Northwest 2nd 409, that is a case that allows a procedural unfairness claim under a unreasonable, arbitrary, or capricious umbrella. This is not a due process claim. We argued that this line of facts that I lay out in the briefing, we argue that those line of facts amounted to a procedural due process claim and procedural unfairness under unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious decision making. On appeal is not the due process claim. It's only the unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious avenue for this. And the case law allows off-the-record evidence to be submitted to prove that the procedural unfairness resulted in arbitrary or capricious decision-making. The list I have in the memorandum and briefing is that Cronmiller mobilized opposition to the hearing. Yeah. Cronmiller allowed his decisions to be affected by his conflicts of interest and bias, that Scandia misdirected the appellants on which ordinances apply, and that Scandia helped form the DNR and watershed opposition letters.
You don't cite any statute or ordinance that's being violated. Can you give us any authority that would guide us in making those determinations?
Yes, I can give you authority. I can give you an unpublished Court of Appeals case, Continental Property Group versus Minneapolis.
Right, you're relying on Continental Property, but you don't present any evidence that there was any overt swaying by the council members, as was evident in that case. I mean, don't we have a different situation here? Sending letters and indicating to other individuals that this is going to take place certainly isn't swaying an opinion.
Well, there's two levels to this. What Cronmiller was doing, he's a former watershed manager. Those are his friends. He knew that they would oppose a hearing. That's specifically the reason he invited them to the hearing, is saying we need more
people. You don't have that in the record. There wasn't any record evidence that he said, come to the hearing and support me. I need to have your presence here to strengthen or buoy up my position. You've also cited the conflict of interest as far as Cronmiller and Ness are concerned, but you know, there is no case law that supports just being a non-riparian owner that you have an automatic conflict of interest. If there's anything you can point me to, please do so.
My time is up. May I answer that question?
You may answer the question and then you can wrap up. Thank you.
So for the bias point of this, I will cite again to Continental Property versus Minneapolis. And I agree, living on the lake and being part of the negotiations on its own is not disqualifying of Cronmiller. But if you review the record, it's clear he could not remove himself from his role in the original development agreement, which is irrelevant to the question of whether it can be amended, because Scandia has acknowledged it can be amended. And he also could not remove himself from being a landowner, as multiple times he said something along the lines of riparian lots get docks, other lots don't get docks, which is the exact opposite of the purpose of the first tier ordinance and the controlled access lots ordinance, which is to give non-riparian landowners lake access within the development. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Anderson. You will have the opportunity to provide a rebuttal argument. We will next move on to the argument on behalf of respondent, and Mr. Merwin, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and Mr. Anderson. My name is Paul Merwin, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, the City of Scandia. Can you hear me okay? Am I connection okay? Great. We've briefed this extensively, and it's obvious you've read it, so I am not going to focus on all the details unless the court would like me to, but I do want to make two main points to emphasize, and those go to the rational basis of the city to deny it, and then the due process issue. Going first with the rational basis to deny, it was denied because it didn't meet the standards for approval, and that is the applicant's responsibility when they submit an application to present the information necessary for approval. And they did not do so, so it was reasonable for the city to deny it. And there were two main issues that the city found when it adopted written findings about the standard for approval. The first is that first tier ordinance that was discussed earlier. You know, there was some question about whether it's ambiguous. It's not. It's got some math in it. It does yield a specific number. And that specific number gives you the number of space you get to park watercraft, which is hard to read any other way than a place to put a boat, which is a place to put one boat. Otherwise, it doesn't really make any sense that you're doing math that gives you a specific number. And the math that you apply there is based on the DNR model ordinance, and it sort of reflects what a planned unit development is which is, not to get too land use attorney wonky here, but you know, traditional zoning is sort of lot and block zoning, where everybody has a piece of property and your individual lot has to be so big and you have to have setbacks that are so far from the lot lines and so on. Well, planned unit development is a looks at the development as a whole, and it gives some flexibility to the developer when they build it in order to build, you know, maybe you don't have to be, lots don't have to be so big individually. Maybe you can have them clustered a little more dense. In exchange, you have some more setback somewhere else. Or in exchange for that, you put it a little further back from the dock. Or in this case, maybe you, each lot that kind of is near the water doesn't have its own dock, but you have one central dock. And the ordinance looks at, in those planned unit developments specifically, well, how do you figure out, if you're not giving every property owner their individual dock, how do you figure out how many docks apply when you might not have the houses all lined up in a row on the shoreline? And there's math that you do. You look at, well, how many units do you have? How many of them are in what's referred to as the first tier, the closest to the lake? You have to do some survey data. You know, it's 267 feet back from the shoreline, but shorelines are not nice straight lines. They have all sorts of bends and curves. And it's also the developable area in that. And then you figure that out. That's your total area. And then you divide it by the minimum lot size, which in this case is 2.5 acres. Now, the most fatal flaw in the applicant's problem here, application here, the problem was there's nothing in their ordinance, or I'm sorry, their application or in the record about how much land is in tier one, how much developable land is in tier one. They do provide some information about the linear shoreline. In their complaint, they said they had 3,500 feet of shoreline. They're saying today they have 4,000 feet of shoreline. And that's maybe one component of the math, because you length times width gets you area, but we don't really know the developable area. That was never submitted. So we don't have the information to do that math. That was never submitted. The plaintiffs argued and cited to an unpublished case called Gorley. And I think, we noted that case ironically weighs against them because it was very similar facts, in which the DNR had granted a permit where someone didn't submit the necessary information, sort of some technical data they needed to do a calculation. And the court said that was a specific standard. Close was not good enough. They even though they were substantially close, the DNR had argued that we pretty much got what we need. The court said, no, the ordinance, or the rule of statute says, you got to do this a calculation and you didn't do it. Therefore, you can't approve it. And so that was the first tier ordinance part of it. The other part of this is that this is a conditional use permit. All conditional use permits have to meet certain standards dealing with the general welfare, about the suitability of public waters to accommodate, that there won't be negative impacts on a public resource. And the city made specific findings about that. There was testimony in the record from, for example, a conservation biologist about the impacts of additional docks on this small, this is a small isolated bay that was previously, pretty much blocked off from the main lake. So this is a little different than the main lake. It has a very sensitive ecosystem. It's a little pocket bay, highly vegetated. And so there were concerns that have been raised about that, the impacts on that since 2006, and raised consistently to this day, and were raised again in this hearing. And the city heard evidence on that. The applicants had a chance to respond to that evidence. And the city made written findings. And that's what the city is expected to do. They had substantial evidence in the record to support that decision, and it was a rational, and they had a rational basis to make that decision. So they denied it based on those, and they would ask the court to uphold that. Turning to the due process questions, due process in this quasi-judicial process means a notice and an opportunity to be heard. And as I just suggested, they had that in this case. These issues were all presented to the city council. They were testified to. The applicants had an opportunity to respond to them and did so on the record, both in writing and in oral testimony to the planning commission and the city council. The case law also makes clear that, this is quasi-judicial. It's not entirely judicial. We don't have quite the full panoply of judicial process. But there's no doubt that there was an open and a fair hearing in this case. As I think one of the members of this court pointed out, we don't have anything from the appellants here about what controlling legal standard might have been violated. These are sort of these general, this wasn't fair, but there's nothing saying, you know, here's the rule and here's what they did wrong. Appellants specifically note in their brief, the city can't ignore the explicit statutory requirements, but then they never go on to identify what explicit statutory requirements are you talking about? What specifically did the city, you know, do wrong here? The process simply was not defective. There was some, you know, well, you didn't give us the right information about what we were supposed to apply for example. But again, the law makes clear that it's the applicant's responsibility to know the ordinance, to read the ordinance, and submit the necessary information. I will note, that's my prepared part. I just to respond briefly to a couple of the points that were made when the appellant was talking. The one quote that really jumped out at me was the statement that, both the controlled access ordinance and the first year ordinance apply and can work in harmony. I'm not sure that's a direct contradiction, but I think it's a bit of a shift in tone. There's no doubt that the planned unit development requirements apply here. And I don't think there's any realistic argument that they're unclear. I've briefed it about, the question of whether the term space and watercraft are ambiguous and whether they've been applied fairly. And as I suggested at the beginning, and maybe just to emphasize again, that it's really hard to read the word space and watercraft in a way that is anything other than a space to dock a boat. That's how it's been applied originally when they got their permit for 19 slips. That's how it's, been, was referred to in all of the discussions at the city council. This is not an argument that came up, when the applicants were asking for 10 additional slips. It was clearly for 10 additional boats. They talked specifically about how there were questions at the council about, which houses will put a boat on that slip. Is this enough boats for everybody? Are you going to come back to us later because maybe then you don't have enough boats and somebody else wants to put a boat on the slip? I mean, that was clearly the context that was being discussed all along in the real world. And just on its face, the terms space and watercraft are not ambiguous, especially again, when you're doing a calculation to get a specific number. So with that, I have time left, but I've addressed the points that I feel we need to address. I'm happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'll wrap up.
Just one question. The district court spent some time applying the controlled access lot formula here, and sort of doing the math. I just want to make sure that your argument is this is a PUD. We just look to the ordinances governing PUD. This is not a controlled access lot. I mean, is that essentially what your argument is?
Yeah, I would say that because that's the limiting factor. We could argue certainly that both standards apply. You have to meet both the area standards of the PUD and the linear standards of the controlled access lot. But the controlled access lot is not the limiting factor here. The limiting factor is the amount of space under the planned unit development ordinance or the planned unit, the first tier standard that's in the planned unit development section of the ordinance. So that's the one that controls.
Okay, and any other questions from the other members of the panel? No. Thank you, Mr. Merwin.
Thank you,
for your argument. And now, Mr. Anderson, you may give a rebuttal argument if you'd like to.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll touch on a couple of things here. Again, on appeal is not due process. The procedural issues still are under the umbrella of an unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious decision. The other point I'd like to make is that Mr. Merwin had stated that the most fatal part of appellant's claim is that we did not do a first-tier density analysis. Well, that dovetails into these procedural issues because the appellants were being told that controlled access lot ordinance applies. No one early on when they're doing their application, including people from the city, thought that this was a first-tier ordinance application. This was all controlled access lot. And that's the reason why this is so important is that now to this day, the argument is because you didn't follow the ordinance, we told you didn't apply. Now today, you can't even appeal your decision. So that's the prejudice here. That's how it undermines the purpose of the process. And absolutely, this is not a shift in tone. This is not a contradiction. From the very beginning, this has been an argument that there's a slip limit, or that there's a spaces limit, and then there's a boat limit, and that the city incorrectly used the spaces limit as a boat limit. And again, when we're talking about docks like we are in this case, it maybe makes more sense, but this ordinance needs to be applied to the beaching and mooring of watercraft, not just the docking of watercraft. That's what makes it ambiguous. There is no just single space where you can beach. It doesn't make any sense. The ordinance only makes sense if watercraft is plural. That means many watercraft in a single space. There's an example I can give of a public boat launch. There might be one dock at a public boat launch, but on a busy day, there's two boats tied off to it, another boat beached next to it, and someone backing in. One space, multiple watercraft. That's how the ordinance works. With that, I will end my time as well.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The matter is now submitted, and we will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.